They came to take advantage of a new frontier. Land, plentiful and cheap, was incentive to grow, and grow they did. In a few short years, they tamed the wild out of the West. And this leads us to ask, how did they tame the wild out of the West?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now, get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1188th edition of the Food Chain right here on the radio, and perhaps you're among our friends way down there in Buenos Aires who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, as a native son of Montana, I grew up immersed in the cowboy culture that tamed the Wild West. Uncle Walt was the scion of the world champion Red Lodge Linderman clan, a PRCA champion steer wrestler, and the owner of the steer wrestling horse Scotty that won big money by chasing down the wildly fleeing steers of the West's steer wrestlers. And as a writer in search of a great story, I spent a good solid week interviewing 93-year-old Alice Greenough, whose life story will be titled 10,000 Bucking Horses. And daughter Kelsey, as a very tiny toddler, was given her first horseback ride by Turk Greenough, who was arguably the greatest saddle bronc rider of all time. Given this proximity to cowboys and girls, I came to think that it was their incredible toughness of character that enabled them to tame the Wild West. But then I read Aloha Rodeo, and I realized they were not the only ones taming the wild out of the West. And so today we travel up to Portland to ask, how did cowboys and cowgirls and panniolas tame the wild out of the West? Here to help us explore the question, we have David Woolman, who is the co-author of Aloha Rodeo, Three Hawaiian Cowboys, The World's Greatest Rodeo, and A Hidden History of the American West. David, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Yeah, good to have you aboard. How did the two of you and your partner, co-author, Julian Smith, how did you come across this incredible story?
Well, on a family vacation to the island of Hawaii a number of years ago, I had bumped into a statue commemorating the 1908 victory in the steer roping competition at the Cheyenne Frontier Days in Cheyenne, Wyoming. The statue is of a guy named Ikua Purdy, who won the title that year. And he's a Hawaiian guy. And that was about it, as far as information available to a curious onlooker. And right away, I was just hit with a million questions. I wanted to know more about this guy's life and where he came from and how he became so good at roping and how cowboys came to the islands in the first place and what was it like for him to travel to Wyoming and arrive in San Francisco soon after the great earthquake and ride the train all the way to Cheyenne and how were they received when they got there. And, you know, when as a writer, you're always on the lookout for the next
good
captivating
story.
Topic. Yeah, and you know, that doesn't stop on vacation, and I can't turn it off, even if I wanted to, and maybe to my wife's chagrin. And so, but with this one, I think we're happy. I'm happy, and she better be, because it really, once I got home and started researching, I realized, holy cow, there's an incredible yarn here to be shared that very few people know anything about.
Well, and even myself, I had no idea, and though I was raised in that, you know, world, I had no idea about the panniola. But beyond that, really, how the West was tamed by the cow. And what a story. So it's an incredibly illuminating piece of work. So on behalf of us, all of us who love the Wild West, thank you. It's fun read. So I have to ask you, though, how do you work with a co-author in writing a book? Do you share assignments, like you take chapter 3 and I'll take chapter 4?
Well, so Julian and I had actually co-written a long-form article a number of years ago, and that process went well. We liked the final product. Our friendship stayed intact. And interestingly, that story had a kind of natural division of labor. I was going to spend more time with and profile one guy. Julian would do the same with the other guy who was kind of his nemesis in this story. And then later, we would draft some stuff and then start to really stitch it together. And, you know, by the later stages of writing something, you're editing so much that you really can't tell whose fingers did what.
So it just kind of blends together. You don't have to blend it together. Just through the process of editing and proofing and proofing and editing, it just kind of works out that way.
You know, I think there's some truth to that. This book had a similar kind of natural division at first with the reporting and the writing. You know, I kind of led the charge with the Hawaii angle, and Julian led the charge with researching Wyoming and the rise and fall of Cheyenne and the evolution of this great rodeo and festival, the Cheyenne Frontier Days. And, you know, as we're leading up to the climax of the story when those two worlds collide in 1908. So we did sort of divide it up like that at first. Mm-hmm. And similarly, there is that first solitary, difficult attempt at a first draft of a chapter. And so I kind of had the Hawaii stuff and Julian had the Wyoming. But later, you're editing so much and scrutinizing every word in a way that it does, we hope, become a seamless read so that people can't really hear a big difference in voice, for example, by the end.
That was interesting because I couldn't. That's why I asked the question. How did that work? It was great stuff. So let's go back and start from the beginning. The Wild West, to me, this surprising fact that the Wild West, the taming of the Wild West, did not start in the American West. It started in Hawaii. Am I wrong?
Well, I mean, I think you're partially right. I think, look, a big part of our goal with this book was to overturn simplistic notions of cowboys and Indians and this binary sense of who was here, who wasn't, what color is a cowboy. And the story of Hawaiian cowboys helps do that in spades. But as far as kind of the nuts and bolts of what happened here, it was really the Spanish vaqueros who were the first cowboys on what we would call the North American continent, because the United States did not stretch out to the West Coast at that time. So this is Spanish California, where the first great ranches are being run.
Before vaqueros, there had to be cows. How the hell did cows get on Hawaii?
So the cows get to Hawaii. We're not quite at Hawaii yet.
Oh, okay.
So we have this vibrant ranching and cowboy traditions on the west coast of the U.S. Of North America. That is the vaqueros, and at the same time, the British Empire, always trying to explore and gobble up new places, is trying to reestablish relations with the Kingdom of Hawaii. This is at the very end of the 17th century. And Captain George Vancouver arrives in Hawaii with a gift of some Spanish longhorn cattle, which he had actually picked up here in California. And this was a gift to the king to try and get relations going in the right direction after they had kind of collapsed with first contact with Captain Cook about 15, 20 years prior, who was killed on the spot. And these cattle end up reproducing wildly in the islands. The king sets a taboo. No one is allowed to kill them. And people obey that kind of rule in a kingdom like Kamehameha Hawaii, because if you broke the taboo, you would have been killed yourself. And over the next 20 or 30 years, there is this population explosion of cattle throughout the islands. And, you know, the island of Hawaii, we call it the Big Island, it's only about the size of Los Angeles County. And there are estimates that say there is up to 20,000 feral cattle running all over the place there.
And these were not just cows. These were not Jersey cows. These were longhorns. They're mean.
Yeah, these are wild animals. These are mean, wild animals. And it's an important distinction, right? Because nowadays we hear the word cattle, or especially cows, and we have sort of a I at least still have this kind of image of a docile creature grazing on a farm in Vermont or Texas or something. And in fact, these were wild animals. Their horns could stretch. It could be a span of like 5 feet or more. They were very savvy survivors. Even just to have endured the maritime voyage to get there meant that these were some of the hardiest animals there were. And so their offspring would be that much tougher. And so what happens with this kind of ecological emergency in the islands, now we're in the year maybe 1825, 1830, is that the king had gotten wind of these great ranches on the west coast of North America, and they essentially sent for some help. And a handful of Spanish vaqueros, the Spanish-Mexican cowboys, travel to the islands and become mentors to the Hawaiian people, teaching them how to control the animals, how to build fences, work the grazing lands, and of course rope the animals, and get this population problem under control. And in short order, the Hawaiians become very good at this craft, so much so I think that the vaqueros kind of put themselves out of a job. And this is the birth of the great ranches and cowboy culture of Hawaii, which happens, you know, a good 20, 30 years before there are American cowboys working in places like Texas or Nebraska.
Wow. And, of course, their tradition lives on in the ukulele, right?
Yeah, the ukulele was a big part of that tradition. And, you know, that's what's one of the beautiful things about, you know, about this story, I think, or about Hawaii in general, is that it is this wonderful melting pot, kind of the true melting pot, both ethnically and culturally. And it did not take long for some of these vaquero traditions to really become Hawaiian traditions, and the ornamentation on their saddle or their clothing, for example, or the music that they would play at a remote cowboy station. And in fact, Hawaii is such a melting pot at that time that you would have Portuguese influence, and Chinese influence, and Japanese influence when some of the cowboys would arrive at a like a little cabin, a super rustic little cabin to spend the night after working from, let's say, 3 a.m. that morning until sunset. They get to a cabin, they'll break some branches off a tree to turn into chopsticks to eat some of their snacks that are a combination of salted or dried salted beef that was a vaquero tradition, or some poi, which is like the pounded taro root that's very common throughout Polynesia. And they, someone else's job would be to heat the hot water, to make a fire to heat the hot water for the Japanese-style ofuro bath. And so you see in this, like, 15-foot by 15-foot cabin, this wonderful international melting pot of traditions and culture that I think, well, for me at least, I just found really, really fascinating.
And, of course, it all giving birth to the great Parker Ranch and the tradition of the Hawaiian cowboy. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host, with David Wolman. He is the co-author of Aloha Rodeo. We're talking a little bit about how cowboys and girls and Paolini, did I get that right? Settle the Wild West. How does that word? Yes, it's paniolas, right? Did I get it right, David? Paniolas.
Paniolo. It's paniolo. And, yeah, interestingly, the plural has no S, so it's just paniolo.
Okay, quick break. Quick break. Hold that. Quick break. Right back.
Let's go back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, the word in Hawaiian is paniolos. Did I get it right that time, David Wolman?
Almost.
Almost. Okay. I love the Hawaiian language. I just haven't figured it out yet.
Well, me neither. I'm not a scholar of Hawaiian language. But the word paniolo...
Paniolo,
it speaks to this vaquero traditions that you and I were talking about earlier. It's kind of a Hawaiianized version of Espanol. And that is sort of a linguistic hat tip to the first cowboys who came to the islands to teach the Hawaiians how to manage the wild cattle. So that's where the word paniolo comes from today. And even though, you know, a lot of the ranches today have been closed down. There's a handful that are still in operation. And what's wonderful to see in Hawaii nowadays is that Paniolo culture and celebrating this history is kind of alive and well. You know, there's rodeos happening all over the place. And I think people there today are really still proud of this heritage.
I had the opportunity to do a live radio show from the Ulapala Kua Ranch on Maui early one Saturday morning. And it was, what a wonderful experience that was. But how did these vaqueros teach the Hawaiian people how to bring these incredibly wild cattle under control and turn that whole world into something like the Parker Ranch?
Well, I think it was a combination of all the tools that you would think of when you think of modern-day ranching. You know, the most basic of which is fencing. But then also using horses to chase down and then to rope and corral the animals. And then, of course, there is the more sort of commercial element to all of this processes with getting animals to a slaughterhouse or castration and all the other ways that herds have to be managed so that they don't take over the entire landscape. So the vaqueros really brought all of that know-how and more to the islands. At the same time, there are a number of, I would say, enterprising people or entrepreneurs, sort of natural entrepreneurs in the islands, who can see the potential of this new industry as a real moneymaker. And chief among them is a guy named John Palmer Parker. And Parker had left Newton, Massachusetts on a trading vessel in the early 1800s, got to Hawaii and decided, like a lot of people, that he wanted to stay. And in short order, he married a princess and had that ear of the king and had been gifted some land. And from that little toehold of land ownership, over time, he would build what would become, you know, one of the greatest ranching empires in American history. You know, almost 300,000 acres on the Big Island were under the rule of the Parker Ranch. And that is where the heroes of our story who go to Wyoming in 1908, that's the ranch where they lived and worked.
And one of the great things that they did in their work was track down these wild steers way up in the jungles of the mountains and drag them out. And it was with the vaquero's lariat that they really learned how to gain control, right?
That's right. And there's a interesting moment when between the population explosion and when it's finally coming under control, you know, the king did hire certain people to try and hunt them. These were the bullock hunters, bullock really just to describe the feral cattle. And they had some success, you know. They were killing a lot of animals, for lack of a better term, but they still could not nearly keep up with the population explosion. So they had sort of the hunting and chasing them down thing, but they didn't know how to control the population more generally and really turn this into an industry. And it was with the lariat, especially, and the vaquero's expertise with that tool that the Hawaiians started to realize that this was their way to control the animals and not necessarily a gun.
So with the lariat, they could throw a lasso around one of these wild, crazy bulls and bring them into submission, kind of, at least. But they're incredible animals, and they're ferocious, and they, you know, were not domesticated in the least bit. And so how did they go about bringing into submission one of these giant wild steers or bulls with a lariat?
Yeah, it was both. It was the bulls and the cows and the steers, all of them wild and dangerous. And so what they would do is they would hunt the cattle, they would say up on the mountain. And what they're talking about there is generally Mauna Kea on the island of Hawaii, the great volcano. But, of course, it was throughout the high country of all the major islands. So they would hunt as in search for the animals. When they found them, they would chase them and lasso them, And then they had two ways of sort of bringing them into submission. One was the animals are protesting so wildly, there's no way they're going to be able to just ride it down the mountain. So they would tie them off to a tree and let the animals kind of burn themselves out so that later in the day or even the following day, the animals would be hopefully exhausted enough to be more submissive, and then they could be led down the mountain. The other way they would do it is they would tie them off to an already tame ox and have that animal lead the wild cattle down the mountain, sort of one at a time. And this seemed to be another sort of effective strategy. They also wouldn't come all the way down to the seashore or anything like that. They had sort of staged corrals at different elevations coming down the mountain. Again, because these animals were so wild, they needed to get them into a corral mm-hmm. pretty quickly.
And in those corrals, of course, they were processed. I guess the word is used today, or butchered as it was used in the past, and rendered into products. And the products, what kind of products did they make out of those wild cattle?
Yeah, so on Hawaii, mostly they were shipping material overseas, but again, people like John Palmer Parker and some of these early entrepreneurs who saw the writing on the wall with like a burgeoning industry, they were providing salted beef, for example, to all of the whaling ships that were in port for the winter at places like Honolulu to resupply. And then they were also primarily fueling the hide and tallow markets abroad, sending material to London and New England and to Asia. You know, I saw a book last year in Hawaii that in fact, on the inside, it was from about 1858. And inside, it said the name of the company. I can't remember what it was, but it was printed. It was manufactured in Massachusetts, this beautiful leather-bound book. And it's totally conceivable that the material to make that leather-bound book came from a cow raised on the Parker Ranch in Hawaii, you know, only for that book to then be sent back to the islands. And it's a pretty nerdy example, but I just love thinking about it because to me, it's such a reminder of how this great big world is not really that big at all.
Really? And made possible, of course, by ships. And it was probably easier to get a ship from Hawaii to Boston than it would have been to get it overland by wagon train or whatever at that time. Let's take the story then to the other cowboys, which of course were in the Wild West or of America, the American continent, North American continent. And after the Louisiana Purchase, the United States had a big new chunk of land filled with buffalo. What do we do?
Oh yeah, we killed them all in short order. You know, this is some of the dark side of the quote unquote taming of the frontier is displacing native inhabitants first and foremost, and as well all the buffalo. And once the buffalo are essentially gone, you have all of this open grassland that is basically calling out to anyone with an entrepreneurial mindset to start a ranch and to raise cattle. And so that's when we see sort of the birth of the cattle industry in Great Plains.
There's free grass and that we stole from the
free
buffalo.
Grass here, but there's the free grass that we stole from the buffalo and Native Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And as the ranching industry explodes in places like Texas and Oklahoma, the locals there are thinking of other places where they can get the cattle to find more food for them, frankly. And there's this ocean of grass in Wyoming just beckoning. All they have to do is get the cattle there, and that's where we see the great cattle drives, you know, of sort of a la Lonesome Dove, for example.
Right.
And this, in turn, helps turn Cheyenne from this, like, nothing little outpost that people are just traveling through on their way to Oregon or to chase gold riches in California. It very quickly helps turn Cheyenne into this kind of very cosmopolitan, very rich, important little epicenter of the American West, because it had two things. It had the ocean of grass, and it also had rail connectivity so that you could get the cattle to markets back east.
Yeah, it was the big deal, right? Because not even Denver had a railhead at that time.
Exactly. Denver was connected to Cheyenne, I think, by rail, mm-hmm. but not the points to the east. And Cheyenne has this sort of interesting, or I would say kind of amusing, ongoing rivalry with Denver. But in this moment, Cheyenne really won out because it had so much terrain for grazing and then also the railroad. And so in the book, you know, we try to document this, like, very rapid rise of Cheyenne into this very wealthy place. At one point, perhaps the wealthiest per capita, wealthiest town in America, with this gorgeous opera house and chandeliers and beautiful Victorian homes lining the main street. And then it all comes crashing down once more homesteaders arrive and start fencing off smaller homesteads of the Great Plains, because now they're... this great roaming, these great huge ranches,
the free
can't
grass.
Really exist anymore. The free grass.
The free grass is gone. The homesteaders have arrived, and that probably explains why cowboys never did like farmers. But it gets right down to it. So we're in a big fix then in Cheyenne, Wyoming, because the homesteaders have come. They fenced off everything. The great ranches of the area are withering away. So we need to figure out what to do. What do we do?
There's a wonderful line that we found in a newspaper of some town leaders in Cheyenne puzzling over that exact question. And as a possible moneymaker, I don't think necessarily they thought of it as a fix for all of their financial woes, but someone brought up the fact that all these other nearby cities, like Denver and Laramie, they had these various festivals and celebrations, even some rodeo competitions. Somebody else had, like, the Potato Day.
I think that was Colorado, wasn't it? They had a potato festival or something like that?
It was. I think it was. So they're wondering, well, what can we do here in Cheyenne? And someone says, you know, we don't raise anything in Cheyenne except hell. And eventually they say, well, let's try a rodeo, because we've got all this cowboy talent, you know, a lot of it kind of sitting idle now that the ranches have been consolidated or diminished. And so they decide to hold this rodeo. They call it Cheyenne Frontier Days. And it's a little more than an entrepreneurial whim, but it becomes arguably the greatest rodeo in the world. It's attracting riders and spectators from all across the West, and soon from points east and even from Europe. And by the time we get sort of to the climax or near the climax of our story in 1908, you know, there are tens of thousands of people traveling to Cheyenne to witness this spectacle every year. And into that scene ride these three foreigners from Hawaii.
From Hawaii. Now, was this before or after Buffalo Bill's Wild West show?
It was during. And so one of the things that we really enjoyed looking into while doing this research was this bizarre phenomenon of the life in the Wild West turning into the myth of the Wild West almost in real time. You know, people were just scraping by. They were fresh off conflicts with Native Americans. Life was really hard out there, and yet they had a lot of pride in the work they were doing, especially when it came to cowboy culture. And almost at the same time, America as a whole is getting cowboy fever and Wild West fever. And this is through dime novels and the stories of Buffalo Bill Cody. His Wild West show is traveling all over the country and even to Europe. He's one of the most famous names on the entire planet at that time. And he plays such an important role, not just in the story of Cheyenne and Cheyenne Frontier Days, but really in this much wider story of etching the romanticized version of the West into the soul of Americans, of all of us. You know, even just the way we respond to the word cowboy today. And Cody played a huge role in that whole process. And he also helped build up Cheyenne Frontier Days so that, you know, when we have our moment with the Hawaiians riding into town, it's that much bigger of a spectacle.
And Buffalo Bill Cody. Nobody did it better than Buffalo Bill Cody because he put on a show that everybody talked about and loved to participate in. When we come back from this break, we're going to talk a little bit about the modern rodeo and some of the events that took place in it back then. And then we're going to bring these three Hawaiian, now I'm going to blow the word again, paniolas to Cheyenne, Wyoming, and see what happens when the Hawaiians meet the cowboys of the West. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson with David Wolman, who is a co-author of Aloha Rodeo. Aloha Rodeo. And you, right back. Stay tuned.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, right now we're in Cheyenne, Wyoming, talking with David Wolman, who is the co-author of Aloha Rodeo. You ever go to Cheyenne, David?
I have been a while ago. I actually went to Frontier Days.
Oh, good. Was it what you thought it would be when you went?
It was enormous, and it's only gotten bigger since then. You know, my co-author spent a good amount of time there while we were doing research for the book, and you know, it's just a huge party and Western culture celebration, and of course, a lot of sports competition as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go back to the early rodeo and talk about some of the events that took place and then made up that rodeo. And one of the first things that comes to mind, of course, is the wild horse race. How exactly does that work?
Yeah, there were some events that really, really were wild. There's no other word for it. So, of course, at that time in the West, there are thousands and thousands of horses everywhere that are just run free.
Running free.
And for this event, they took some wild horses, managed to rope them and get them to the arena. They would blindfold them and then bring them out into the rodeo grounds. And then when someone yelled go, a cowboy and an assistant would race to try and saddle and bridle this animal, and then if they were successful doing that, try and ride them around the track. And of course, you can sort of picture the total chaos that's happening, let alone more than a small degree of animal cruelty. But it was happening, and it was sort of part of that mm-hmm. time and era. And I think there was, I think people in the stands at that time they liked the drama of kind of these near-death experiences.
Can you imagine the humor, you know, of trying to watch somebody ride saddle up and ride a horse that had never been ridden? I mean, it must have been pretty hilarious.
I think you're right, and I think so many times the horses are outsmarting the humans in that kind of situation anyway, that it may have been as much a matter of enjoying the folly as it was, relishing in the sports competition.
And all of these events in the modern rodeo were generated out of the activity of the ranching itself. And you know, when you think about the rodeo, it's, I believe, the only industry, agriculture being the industry, that has its own sport. Now, I might be wrong there, but I think it's also one of the very few industries in which the animals are equal, if not sometimes even more famous than the people involved. Your thoughts?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I think maybe horse racing is similar, but, you know, they share so much history. I think your point also speaks to kind of the spirit of sportsmanship that I think a lot of cowboys bring to rodeo, because at the end of the day, for working cowboys, these rodeo competitions were just sort of a sideshow fun thing to do. This wasn't how they made their living. They made their living doing the hard work of roping and managing cattle in, you know, in very remote and difficult terrain with far more hazards than they would ever face in the very tame rodeo grounds on nice flat grass or on the, you know, the manicured dirt. Or
with people applauding in the stands. And,
right, and so I think for a lot of them, yes, they were competitive, and yes, it's a really thrilling sport to watch. But for a lot of them, there was an element of just being involved in entertainment, and not so much that I want to be the next great professional rodeo rider. There wasn't a way to make a living back then.
You know, you tell, and the animals also seem to enjoy the entertainment value of everything, too. You tell a wonderful story about a horse who continually bucked off all of the saddlebronc riders into the dirt, and then the horse would walk over to the stands for his applause, and it was like being fed, almost a treat. But it seems like the animals really get into the performance as well as the riders themselves.
You know, there are definitely hints of that. You know, I can't put myself in the mind of a horse, but the horse you're talking about is Steamboat, who really is an important character in our story because it's arguably one of the most famous bucking broncos in rodeo history. And at this 1908 competition that we're showcasing, there's just an incredible contest between two guys that I don't want to give it all away, but by that point, Steamboat was very famous throughout the West as one of the most uncooperative animals in the history of the sport. And you're right, there are signs, at least if the newspaper accounts are to be believed or even partially believed, that Steamboat did sort of relish the experience of being on the stage. And by that I mean he was known to not start protesting or bucking until really it was time to. And then as soon as a rider was thrown or Steamboat was brought out of the rodeo grounds, he was pretty mellow. Now you could argue, and probably convincingly so, that this is just an animal conserving its energy for the next bout or just eager for some food or what have you. But he had this, what to audiences looked like, a showman's instinct, and I think that's part of the lore of Steamboat that makes him so enjoyable to read about.
Well, I had an opportunity to get to know my Uncle Walt's bulldogging horse, Scotty, very well, and had the opportunity to watch him in action a number of times, and I swear to good God that this horse loved the competition, loved running down the steers, loved having his rider leap off his back and onto the back of the steer and drag the steer. It just seemed like he was having so much fun. But that's what the rodeos were. They were a lot of fun for a lot of people. And now let's figure out how on earth we get these three Hawaiian cowboys, these Paniolos from Hawaii, all the way from the mountains of the Big Island all the way to Cheyenne, Wyoming. Take it away, David Woolman.
Well, we'll pick up the story in the early 1900s. Rodeo and Wild West fever is alive and well in the islands as well.
So they're having rodeos there as well, right?
Yeah, they have Wild West shows, they have rodeo competitions, and this kid named Ikua Purdy is fast becoming known as sort of the gem of the islands, the best roper that Hawaii has to offer. And at the same time, one of his cousins is a guy named Eben Lowe, who actually lost the hand in a roping accident, but it remained one of the most talented Paniolo in the islands. And Eben is so interesting because he's kind of this impresario, Will Rogers-like character, almost an ambassador for Hawaiian cowboy culture at a time when, you know, if you think today we don't know much about cowboy culture in the islands, 110 years ago, it was even more the case. And so Eben Lowe is traveling to Washington, D.C. He has an audience with President Roosevelt. He is traveling to Texas to give a sort of slide-like presentation of what the work is like of running cattle in the islands. Then he gets to Cheyenne Frontier Days in 1907. He goes as a spectator. You know, he's eager to give quotes to the newspaper reporters whenever he can, because it's just sort of his personality. But mostly he's there to watch. And in 1907, Eben is sitting there in the stands watching the steer roping competition. And he thinks to himself, you know, my cousins could beat these guys. And that sets in motion this relationship between Cheyenne and Cheyenne Frontier Days and cowboys in Hawaii. Because as soon as that event is completed, Eben makes his way to some of the Wyoming cowboys and invites them to come to Honolulu for a rodeo and Wild West show that he's putting on the following December. This is 1907. And they agree to do that. And at the same time, everyone is already laying plans for the Hawaiians to travel to the Cheyenne Frontier Days in the summer of 1908. And so that's that sort of sets the stage for when these three men ride into town.
And so they hop on a ship and make the crossing and end up in San Francisco just shortly after the great earthquake. And imagine what their impression would have been to see this great city rising from the ashes the way it did there. Boom. It's built a whole new city very quickly. And then from there, they hopped on a train.
Yeah. From there, they hopped on a train. And this was, you know, the three Paniolo whose lives we follow, you know, they did not keep diaries as far as we know. And so we don't have a lot of firsthand impressions from them, at least in terms of their own thoughts written down or dialogue. There's a couple snippets of like a newspaper interview when they got to Oakland, for example. But you're absolutely right. I mean, imagine they've never left the islands before. They take a steamship to San Francisco, to where the great earthquake had occurred just a couple years previous. Then they take a ferry over to Oakland to board the overland train across the west through the Rocky Mountains to the Front Range and, you know, this town in Wyoming and a landscape that just must have gone on and on and on forever in their eyes. Again, I mean, the Big Island of Hawaii is big, but it's only about the size of Los Angeles County.
Right.
And so for them, it must have been mind-boggling. At least in terms of the landscape. I think culturally, they also probably were really taken aback at a lot of the racism and bigotry that they would have encountered and seen sort of front and center and probably experienced firsthand. Whereas Hawaii, you know, far from being kind of racial utopia, was nevertheless a much more progressive place when it came to ethnic mixing and racial understanding and just treating other people equally, for lack of a more sophisticated term. And so I think that must have been jarring for them. One has to wonder if that added a sense of motivation to, you know, as far as
well,
their
that's exactly
desire.
Right. So we're going to have a contest here.
Exactly. Yeah, we're going to have a contest.
We're going to have a contest here.
I can't project too much, but one has to think that it fed their desire to do well in the final contest, being in this world and being looked at as sort of this interloper from outside.
Well, wasn't that kind of the pitch, though, by the people who were organizing everything? Hey, we're going to have a contest between cowboys of the American West and those silly Hawaiian cowboys. They can't possibly be that good. Wasn't that part of the build up to the event?
I think it really was. And in some ways, there's a sort of contradictory sentiment toward the Hawaiians, because on the one hand, there is a sense of welcoming them, because what better way to illustrate that Cheyenne Frontier Days is the world's preeminent rodeo than to have competitors traveling there from thousands of miles away. So in that, in a way, they're like a great PR tool.
And we're just about out of time here, so we want to get to the event. And the event, of course, was roping. And here are the the Hawaiian cowboys with their wonderful history of the lariat and dragging those incredibly wild cattle right out of the mountains with these lariats. And now they're going to compete with it at the Cheyenne Frontier Days Rodeo. So what happened?
Well, it's interesting. At first, people are looking at them as this kind of oddity. And it's they're curious. They're a little skeptical. And it's a little bit, it feels like the newspaper accounts almost feel like a circus act. You know, oh, neat, look at the Hawaiian guys. But, of course, they can't hold a candle to a real Wyoming cowboy, right? That just isn't going to fly. But then after day one of the competition, when the Hawaiians are performing quite well, I think the newspaper reporters are a little stunned. And then they're really urging their native sons, the Wyoming cowboys, to sort of get off their butts and show these Hawaiians the door and remind them who the best cowboys in the world are. And, of course, that's not how it plays out in the end.
What? How did it play out?
Well, Ikua Purdy takes first. His cousins take third and sixth place. One of them even fought through an asthma attack while he was roping the steer. And in a flash, they really ended up putting Hawaii on the map for a lot of people throughout, not just the American West, but I think America as a whole. There were newspapers as far away as Rochester, New York, were reporting what happened. And, of course, back home, they are greeted as heroes. When the steamship arrived back in Hawaii, there were huge parades and celebrations for them throughout the islands.
And there they were, conquerors of the great American West. And it really was the cowboy and cowgirl of the American West, as well as the paniolos of the Hawaii, that did a lot of the taming of the American West, and got to be thankful that they were there to do it. And got to be thankful that there were two characters, David Woolman and his partner, who went out and found this story and brought it to us in the under the title of Aloha Rodeo. David, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Really appreciate it. Love the story. A great read. And what a fun thing to do, to look back in history and see who tamed the West. Thank you, David.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.